In Genesis chapter 20 this evening, I want to concentrate on four key themes, because I want us to see something of the work and person of God as it's revealed to us in this chapter. And I want you to see that God is sovereign. I want you to see that God is just. I want you to see that God is gracious. I want you to see that God is awesome. And in looking at this chapter together, I just want to highlight six lessons, six key points that we can learn and take to heart ourselves as we continue to consider the life of this man of great faith. First of all, I want you to consider this with me. Not again, Abraham. What are you doing? Has it ever been part of your Christian experience to say to yourself, after a certain event has taken place, I'll never do that again. I've learned my lesson. That simply did not work. Ever said that? And how long was it until you were kicking yourself again because you've gone and done it again? That you know was wrong, that you knew had let God down, that which you had vowed never to repeat, you've done it again. Well, welcome to the AA, because you're in the Abraham Association, if that's been your experience. Because that was Abraham's experience too. Do you remember how back in chapter 12, when Abraham had to go down into Egypt because a great famine had come into the land of Canaan and they were desperate for food, down into Egypt they went. The eyes of Pharaoh fell upon Sarah. He saw what a wonderfully beautiful woman she was, even though she was quite advanced in years. And he took her to be with himself. He saw nothing wrong with it, because Abraham explained, this woman is my sister. Sarah went along with it, yes. Abraham's my brother. And now he's done it all over again. Now, as we saw, and we'll be coming back to this a little bit later, in verse 13, we actually see that this was a determined position that Abraham had taken right from the word go. But surely you would think that Abraham would have realized first time round, well, that plan didn't really work out as we'd expected. That really was a very dodgy situation to be in. That really was not the way to do things. To take things into our own hands, to come up with our own plan, to take on board some kind of scheme that clearly hasn't come from God, but which is simply of our own invention and our own making, surely we'd have learnt things the first time round. And yet here is Abraham, continuing to peddle this line whenever this particular danger ensues. Now, in his defence, it's very, very likely that Abraham's motive behind this really was quite a genuine one, because God had made a particular promise that was to be fulfilled only through himself. And it may well be that Abraham's motive was that, well, I really can't put myself in any position where my life is threatened or my life is in danger, because this promise that God has given is yet to be fulfilled, and so I need to do whatever I can to ensure that this promise will go forward just as God has given it. Even to the point where he's prepared to say something that actually puts his own wife in a very grave situation. But doesn't it show that Abraham, faced with something that he sees as a great danger and a great threat, can't actually bring himself to rely entirely upon God to deal with things. He cannot bring himself to trust this particular situation and this perceived threat to God and to leave it with him. He persists in putting forward this ruse to try and throw people off the scent. And so here he is again, and Sarah once again has been taken by another man, Abimelech. Now, it might seem amazing to you at this point, because Sarah is around 90 years of age, and yet still Abimelech sees something very desirable in this woman, Sarah. She was, in some way, a most remarkable woman. That even at such a great age, someone like Abimelech would desire her. But he did. And Abraham persists. I wonder if you are tempted to do that too. Because we're going to see as the story unfolds that there really is no need to have that kind of mentality. There really is no need to have that kind of fear. There really is no need to think that you've got to take things into your own hands because somehow, well, maybe God can't quite handle it. Because as we're going to see, God can handle things perfectly well if we will just entrust our lives to him, take him at his word, and lean on his promises and find that they're not lacking. Because in verse 3, and secondly, we see that God intervenes. God intervenes. God came to Abimelech in a dream by night. You see, God is not hampered by the interference of a man like Abimelech. And he intervenes. He'll do it again, 1500 years down the line. The remnant of the children of Israel, the people of Judah primarily, are in captivity, having been taken away originally by Nebuchadnezzar, and they're in the land which now is known as Persia. And we read that the new king, who'd come to the throne subsequent to their captivity, in Ezra chapter 1 verse 1, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, that it might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia. God is active for his people. God intervenes for his people in the affairs of men. He spoke to the wise men after they'd found Christ, and they worshipped him. They gave him their gifts. Herod the king had instructed them, "Come back when you find him, that I may go and worship him too." And God, in a dream, spoke to those wise men and told them not to return to Herod. God intervenes in the affairs of men. We read in Proverbs chapter 21, the first verse, "The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. Like the rivers of water, he turns it wherever he wishes." Wherever he wishes. God intervenes. You need to remember that God is a mighty, sovereign God. Now, perhaps you're in a situation right now, or maybe you'll find yourself in a situation in the future, and things seem stacked against you. The odds just seem far too great. The world, perhaps, seems to have the upper hand against you. Perhaps you find that you're tempted to take matters into your own hands without simply seeking the Lord and trusting Him. Never doubt the ability of God to come to the aid of His people, because even the hearts of kings are in the hands of the Lord. And God speaks to Abimelech by night in a dream. And God, even with what Abraham has done again, because He is a gracious God, in He steps, and He will work things out for His people. It's not been a pleasant ride for Abraham. It's probably not been a pleasant ride for Sarah. God never promises to make everything pleasant. But we do have this guarantee that He works and intervenes for the good of His people. We need to take that to heart. In all our daily walk with Him, all the difficulties and adversities that we might face, all the situations that seem to be going against us, God intervenes for His people. And the third thing that we see as the story unfolds is that God is just and gracious. It's very helpful to remember those two things together. God says to Abimelech, "Indeed, you are a dead man because of the woman you have taken. She is a man's wife." I wonder if Abimelech woke up, sweat pouring off his brow. What must it be like to be spoken to by the God of heaven and be told, "You are a dead man"? No wonder he woke up early the next morning and started to do something about it. Abimelech has sinned, and the sin deserves death, because that is God's justice. I need to remind you this evening that God is a God of justice. He's a holy God. He's a righteous God. And before Him, unrighteousness needs to be dealt with. It cannot be overlooked. It cannot be brushed aside. He cannot pat us on the head and say, "There, there, it doesn't really matter." Because it does. God is a God of justice. And when He confronts Abimelech with his sin, He must make it clear what that sin deserves. I need to tell you this evening, my Bible says that every single one of us are sinners. Everyone. And God's justice demands to be fulfilled. My Bible tells me the wages of sin is death. But Abimelech makes a plea. "Lord, will you slay a righteous nation also? Did he not say to me, 'She's my sister'? And even she herself, Sarah, she said, 'Abraham's my brother.'" And Abimelech is saying that I was not knowingly with another man's wife. And God listens to his plea. And God, you'll see as those verses continue, allows him a way out of that situation. He says, "Abimelech, there's something you must do. But if you do it, I will let you live." Because this God of justice is a God of grace. Such a God of grace. Now, I just want to highlight something. The fact that Abimelech didn't understand that what he was doing was wrong, because he didn't realize that Sarah was a married woman, that doesn't stop it from being a sin. The fact that Abimelech didn't know doesn't mean that God can overlook it or ignore it. It's still a sin. And it still deserves death, even though Abimelech was doing it in ignorance. It's a little bit like breaking the speed limit when you don't realise what the speed limit is. We drive into church from the north end of the city down Derby Road, running alongside the river. And for quite a considerable stretch, it's a 40-mile-an-hour limit. And then there's a certain set of traffic lights you come to, and the speed limit changes from 40 to 30. Lots of people fail to notice. And often, not very far down the road, with some degree of regularity, the police will be out with their mobile speed cameras. And it's very rare for you not to see them having pulled someone up. And I can imagine what they say. Oh, sorry, officer. The speed limit's 30. I thought it was 40. I'm very sorry. I didn't realise. Now, the fact that they weren't aware that the speed limit was 30 doesn't mean that they haven't broken the speed limit. Because they have. The fact that they weren't aware that the speed limit had reduced from 40 to 30 won't give them sufficient reason to get off paying a fine and having some points put on their license. Because the fact is, whether they were aware of it or not, they've broken the speed limit. They were doing 37 or maybe more when they should have only been doing 30. And any plea of ignorance is no plea at all. And so the fact that Abimelech says, well, I didn't know, that actually still doesn't stop it from being sin. And indeed, the Bible says, as the Apostle Paul begins to write to the Romans, that no one has any excuse over sin. No one can say, I didn't know, because actually we all know enough. And even if we've never had the Bible open to us, we have a sufficient amount of God's law written in our hearts and written on our consciences to know what the truth is. And God will judge us accordingly. But God is both just and he's gracious. And God offers forgiveness to Abimelech on condition that he does something. And God offers forgiveness because he's so gracious. And fourthly, we see that God protects Sarah in verse 6. God says to Abimelech, having this conversation in the dream, yes, I know that you did this in the integrity of your heart. I also withheld you from sinning against her. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. So Abimelech has taken this woman to be as his wife, but he hasn't laid a finger on her. Why? Because God's at work. What was it in that man Abimelech that in the case of this woman has kept him from being with her? The power and influence of a sovereign God. And that fills me with great encouragement. To know that even when I mess up, that even when I get things terribly wrong, that when even I get myself in a right old pickle, that even when I let God down so terribly, he won't forsake me. And he won't abandon me. And he'll continue to love me. And he'll be so long-suffering with me. Oh, that we were more like Christ with each other and in our own relationships. Oh, that we would be more like God in his grace, in his mercy, in his tenderness, in his long-suffering. And God protects Sarah in the situation. because we have a God who has the power to overrule circumstances. We have a God who has power over the intentions and the actions of men. We have a God who is even able to overrule the lust of a king for a woman and prevent him from doing anything. That's our God. Why are we so slow to trust him? Why do we so easily give in to fear when we have such a God as this? The fifth lesson I want us to learn is in verses 12 and 13. As Abraham explains that he has this agreement with Sarah, his wife. Verse 12, he says, she actually is my sister. She's the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And she became my wife. Now this opens up one of two possibilities. Abraham might be talking of his literal father and his literal mother. In other words, Sarah is a half-sister. And they've married. It could be that when he speaks of father and mother, he's talking a few generations further back. Because in the Bible, when it speaks of fathers and sons, it's not necessarily speaking of just father and son as we understand it today. It can be any kind of generational gap. A man would look back at any of his male predecessors and ancestors and say, he's my father. So Christ is called the Son of David. The Jews would talk of their father, Abraham. So it's not necessarily his immediate father and mother. But there is clearly some relationship link between them that enables Abraham to legitimately call Sarah his sister. Now, of course, later on, when God gives his law to Moses, God actually puts a limit on close family relationships that can actually produce marriage. And he sets a limit on that. But in the early times in the Bible, often close relatives did get married. After all, Adam and Eve's sons and daughters became husbands and wives. But that kind of close family relationship leading to marriage was later outlawed and precluded through the law given to Moses, but that hasn't happened yet. But we see here in Abraham truth used deceitfully. Technically, Sarah did qualify as his sister, but he's giving half the truth in order to try and hide the other half of the truth. Because half the truth is, Sarah's my sister. The other half of the truth is, Sarah is my wife. And Abraham is giving the one half in order that the other half might be hidden and concealed and not made known. And so he's actually speaking something which technically is the truth, but he's actually doing it in order to deceive. And we need to realize that truth can be used that way. We need to make sure that we never do. Perhaps you've been tempted to do that yourself. Well, I'll just give half the story. It is the truth. But your motives are actually to deceive and to hide the other part of the truth that you don't want to be revealed. We need to be those who speak truth in the way that God speaks truth. No ambiguity. No ambiguity in the word of God when God speaks. And that needs to be our heart too. Speaking the truth in love. No misuse. And then the final thing, we see the awesome power of God displayed. Verses 17 and 18. Abraham prays to God at the end of all of this. Sarah's been given back to him. Abimelech's given things to him, gifts to him. And Abraham prays to God as God promised Abimelech that he would. And we read, God healed Abimelech, his wife and his female servants, and they bore children, for the Lord had closed up all the wombs of the household of Abimelech because of Sarah. Never ever think that you can play around with God and get away with it. Now, I don't know whether Abimelech and the ladies in his home even realised the thing that had come upon them. It's not made that clear as to whether they were even aware of what had happened at the time. But God had been at work. Did they perhaps think that there had been no consequences because of what had happened? We must never underestimate the awesome power of our Almighty God. And he's been actively at work on behalf of Abraham and Sarah in doing this thing. He has actively been at work in the hearts and lives of those who do not know him. We need to remember that. Perhaps you're someone, you're not a Christian, you don't know God, and so you think, God has nothing to do with me. God is not in my life, he's not interfering in any way. Don't you be so sure about it. Because we have a God who is awesome in his power, and a God who is sovereign in all of the affairs of men. And for those of us who are believers, how we need to live with all our hope and all our trust in the living God. The one who intervenes on behalf of his people. The one who cares. The one who is just and the one who is so gracious. The one who is so long-suffering towards us. The one who promises to never leave us and to never forsake us. The one who will uphold us by the power of his hand. This is our God. This is the God of Abraham. And this is your God too.